You have to understand that change happens over a long time. And if you want change to last, you have to invest a long time for it to last longer.
Welcome to Climate Humans, a podcast by Hero. Stories about why climate mobilizers are more than heroes, they're humans, just like you and me. This week, I'm speaking with Samia Dumbuya. Samia is one of those special people that forges their own path and has totally defined climate action on her own terms. Growing up between London City Airport and the Tate and Lyle Sugar Factory in East London, it's no surprise that Samia started out in climate as a clean air campaigner. Samia joins us to share her experience across a breadth of climate mobilization, including the vital role of how she effectively creates safe spaces for others. If you're feeling a bit deflated or run down, I can guarantee Samia's insights will give you that boost you need to get back up and try again tomorrow. Please don't forget to hit the follow button wherever you're listening to this podcast. Here's our conversation. Hi, everyone, and welcome. Today I have an incredible guest, Samia Dumbuya. Samia, how are you? And welcome to this episode.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I feel good today. I'm excited to have this conversation because these conversations need to be had.
Perfect. I'm really eager to learn more about you and your story. So let's start by sharing with our listeners, who are you and what brought you close to the climate space?
Yeah, so just to give a bit of background to myself, I was born and raised in inner city London, specifically in East London, in a borough called Newham, which is predominantly Black and Asian. And the neighborhood I lived in between London City Airport and Tate and Lyle Sugar Factory. And those are very polluting industries. And I entered this journey as an air pollution activist, just to highlight that dirty air is bad for us. And I remember at the time, I was like, why am I saying this out loud? Surely we should all know that dirty air is not good for us. Like, we should have clean air. That's a human right. So we had like police brutality, knife crime, just making sure that young people had access to employment opportunities. And yeah, it was just a very hard journey at the beginning just to get people to clearly understand how the environment affects our health and how it affects the general public's health. And I just couldn't find the right language or strategies to get that messaging out there. And as I was digging more into air pollution, I realized, oh, wait, environmental issues tend to be very severe in racialized communities where they reside. And I was like, oh, there's a pattern here. Why are working class people and people who are racialized located in these areas, why they're more affected? And then I looked up terms like environmental racism, environmental classism, where people are situated in areas that are intentionally toxic and polluted just because there's no regard for our health, our bodies, and our well-being. So that just took me onto a journey of like, why is no one talking about the intersectionality between race and environmental issues? And then I was saying these thoughts out loud, and I ended up just meeting people, not just in the UK, but across Europe through the Young Friends of the Earth Europe network. And we noticed patterns across our countries. And then we said, let's sit down together, build tools to resource people to be more aware of why these things are happening. And then when you pull the thread, there's just so much more underneath. So it's like, yeah. Oh, wow, we're talking about capitalism. We're talking about white supremacy. We're talking about green colonialism and just so many other things. And right now in my journey, I just say I'm a climate justice activist because all the issues and struggles we see on the news or on social media, they're very interconnected. No issue is singular. Like, they all share similar connections. And it's definitely a tough, heavy journey because the more you're aware of the issues of the world, the heavy that weight is on your mind. There are days where I'm like, I wish I never picked up a book. I wish I never read a newspaper and found out what's happening elsewhere. I wish I just stayed in a bubble of ignorance. And yeah, when I see injustice, I can't help myself but to stand up for what is right. I physically cannot just ignore issues that I see. So that is why I'm an activist today.
I think so many people feel this way. Like when we become so aware, right, of the inequalities and injustices, it could lead to two things. Inaction, right? Oh, I'm paralyzed. This is too much for me. Like it's very complex. Or I actually choose to do something. And in your case, you chose the latter, which it was to join, to pursue and work with like-minded people to try to address those systemic issues. So how was your process?
Yeah, I think I'll firstly just say my first tip is that you're not alone. Like there's others like you. So I remember at the beginning of my journey, I felt so alone. I felt very anxious. I felt frustrated and angry that other people weren't talking about it. But then when I went online and was searching what groups exist and just seeing what's already there, I realized, oh, wow, there's already people talking about this. And there's people decades before me that were talking about this. So I felt more comforted. And I reached out to people, say, hey, like, I care about this. Can we have a chat? And also, I think when you're feeling the heaviness and the weight and scale of everything, you feel like you have to go in hard as soon as possible. You don't have to do that. It's good to just start small and see where your role can be over time. You're not going to get things done overnight. Campaigning and activist journeys are very long term. Like some of the things we've accomplished as a civilization were because people were just sustainably fighting for justice. Like it wasn't just a one night event that sparked change. Yes, there's key milestones, but you have to understand that change happens over a long time. And if you want change to last, you have to invest a long time for it to last longer. So I think the main point I just want to make is don't try and reinvent the wheel. I know some people like, oh, I want to start this group. I want to do this and that. And it's no, there are already people doing that. And what you do by starting new things is you fragment the movement even further because everyone's doing their own things. But it's like, actually, hang on, that group is doing the same thing as me. Why don't we just join them and pull our resources together? So yeah, just see where you fit in, but also don't be ashamed that you can't take certain actions because of certain limitations. I meet people sometimes, they're like, oh, I can't join this protest just because I'm scared, I'm worried about, you know, policing powers. And some people say, I'm afraid I might get deported because they have unstable citizenship status. And people need to give themselves grace when they just start an activist journey, just because everyone's different. We've got different circumstances. We've got different privileges. So just understand that you can do what's best for your capacity and your time. Like we all have different lives. People have families to take care of. People have children, obligations, like mental health needs. Like, don't worry that you can't do the exact same thing as someone else. Just do what you can in your time.
Yeah, embrace your unique way of approaching these solutions. And I think then embracing that, but do move forward into something that contributes to that collective effort. I think that's key. Now, Samia, once you acknowledge that there's a problem, then you identify those unique ways in which you can contribute. What is it going to take? You talk about change. It's a long game, right? It's certain actions that happen over time. But what are those key systemic changes? Maybe it's through specific policies that need to be enacted. Or what is it exactly what we need to change from the roots?
Yeah. So for me, I grew up with a dad who was a teacher. So education was always in my space, like watching my dad not just teach in public school, he'll also teach students privately in our house, and just watching him creatively think of ways to get students to understand. He taught biology, so some students will really struggle with certain concepts, and he'll just like figure out how to shape the messaging that suits how they understand the world. So he'll use like football references or just like any other way to make something more interesting to them. And that gave me the idea of like, I need to communicate where people are at. And I think lots of activists make this mistake where it's like, oh, because I have this information, I have to communicate it the way I know it. And I'm just going to bombard people with the information that the same way I process it. And that's not a great way of doing community engagement. You need to meet people where they're at and speak their language, understand what their values and beliefs are, and link it to the issue that you're talking about. So in my case, the climate crisis. The climate crisis is so big, expansive. You can link it to so many things. And part of my activism is doing workshops and holding spaces to have these conversations, because unfortunately, capitalism doesn't afford us the time to critically think and deconstruct the world that we live in. So I like to create space and just say, guys, we blocked out this amount of time just to talk about these issues. And I talk to all age ranges. Like this year, I've talked to like kids as young as 11 to art directors who are in their 60s and 70s. And with kids, it's like fun to just use games and like anecdotes and like creative storytelling just to get them to understand what the climate crisis actually is and how it impacts them. I also like to talk about food as well. So especially with groups that are racialized and are from countries elsewhere, because in the UK, we have big migrant communities. My parents were refugees, and I'll just talk about how my parents fled from Sierra Leone, but they always reminisce about their parents growing cassava, yam, like different fruits and vegetables, and starting from there. And it makes the conversation more joyful and colorful, and it doesn't create a burden on people's minds where you just give them the 1.5 Celsius degrees or the polar bears and the melted ice caps. Like, start where people are from and what they actually enjoy. And something that I made imperative in my practice is to talk about people's connection to nature. So it doesn't have to be an extensive story. Like, some people say, oh, when I was a kid, my mom used to take me to the beach a lot and I'll play in the sea, I'll build sandcastles. Some people say, oh yeah, like I used to do picnics, like family gatherings, and we have a barbecue. Everyone has a story that is set in the natural world. And it brings up feelings of nostalgia, childlike joy. It brings peace and serenity when people bring up those stories. So I like to facilitate spaces where people are doing the talking rather than me. I just pose the questions. I set the space. I can put on music that they like. I will provide food. I'll give pillows, blankets, just afford people time, just because that time is stripped away from us on a day-to-day basis. So people have 9-to-5 jobs. They have kids to take care of. They have rent to pay, bills to take care of. It's very overwhelming to live in a capitalist society. So when people come into the space, I don't want to add on to that extra burden. I say, hey, let's start from where you are. Like, where is your energy at? And honestly, I'm in a weird creative climate justice space where I'm experimenting with what works in community engagement, just because I reject the traditional forms of education where I stand in front of a group of people and say, here's what the climate crisis is, .. Many people are already aware. What they want to know is, how does it link to them and the communities? What does it mean for their future? And at the end of my sessions, I like to do a visioning exercise. Like, what exactly do you want to see in the future? You're more likely to have people join a movement when they see what they're actually moving towards to. Because if you're just painting the narrative of doom and like the world is ending and wildfires and everything, which are important facts, they're just going to be like, well, what's the point? I'm just going to sit here and continue as life is. But then if you actually paint almost like a utopia, like a world that they actually want to live in, then they're more likely to strive towards that goal because you visually painted it. So yeah, I'm using like creative tools as well just to engage people, just because I'm tired of talking at people. So yeah, that's where I'm at in the journey.
I love that. And I love the fact that, because I think you're focusing more on listening to how people feel and how they see the world rather than stating the facts. So I really love your approach and I find it super innovative to really engage people. Have you noticed like a specific pattern of what is connecting people to the climate crisis?
Yeah, the pattern I mainly see is people just leaving spaces more empowered and they feel less weight on their shoulders. So at the beginning, when we talk about the climate crisis, people are obviously worried, they're concerned. But then when we have discussions about our specific roles in this fight, whether you know specifically or not, and then you see how tangible and realistic it is to actually have an impact, some people would be like, oh, it's actually not as bad as I thought it would be because I thought I have no political power. I thought I don't have any chance of creating change. But then you see people's eyes light up and it's, oh, well, I can do something. Or some people realize they're already doing something. I remember once in a class where we were just like going through like the workshop content. And I was going through different tools of change. So talk about like protesting, petitioning, photography, just different ways of sparking change. And I paused for a sec. I was like, actually, can one of you guys tell me which one have you participated in? And lots of hands went up. And some people like, oh, I've actually have spoken to my MP about green issues. I actually have written letters to local politicians. And these were people as young as 12 and 11 years old. So that's why I ask questions, because I think in climate spaces, we assume people haven't done anything. And it's like, no, they have. It's just that we don't platform them. And sometimes they're ashamed to speak out because they feel like no one's listening. They don't have enough followers. They feel like, oh, I'm just doing this little tiny itty bitty task. It's not worth celebrating that. So I just want space for people to celebrate themselves. And then they realize like, wow, I am actually a change maker.
Amazing. So as a mobilizer and activist yourself, working with communities and trying to push for that change, one of the recurring challenges that we see is funding part, right? How do you sustain this crucial work over time? What's your take on the importance of financing climate mobilizers, specifically trying to accelerate policy change? And why is it so crucial to support mobilizers financially?
Yeah, unfortunately, lots of mobilizers I know get burnt out because they have to balance and juggle so many things. So they want to dedicate most of their time to fighting for social and climate justice. But then they're like, oh no, I had to be a bartender on these days, or like pick up like random freelance gigs where they need to finance themselves, right? Like you have to pay your rent, your bills, and they just end up burning out because they end up stretching themselves so thinly. So financing climate mobilizers takes off that pressure and they're like, okay, I can actually focus on this work that I actually have the passion and the skills for. Whereas if you don't have that funding, you're just going to feel constantly worrying about managing your finances and just worrying about where you're going to live when the next meal is coming. And that's the last things you want to do when you're fighting for justice. Like in order to fight for justice, you need to be nourished and not burnt out. So I think it'll definitely help with mental and physical well-being just by being financed.
Great. I couldn't agree more, of course. Samia, what, just because obviously I would love to talk with you for hours, but just a last question that we ask all of our guests, what does it mean for you to be a hero?
Yeah, I think for me, it's like dismantling the fact that there's only one hero. It's a community of heroes. I like to tell people my talks and workshops, you can find many heroes on your street if you just look out of your door. And I honestly think there are more heroes than we see on social media. I think it's easy to feel like, oh, there's only a small amount, but there's so much more. Not everyone posts everything on social media. Just check in on your community. Check what's happening in your local area and you'll just find so many heroes and they do so many things. Like a hero doesn't just do the same thing as the other hero. There are people who are nourishing the communities by cooking free meals, redistributing food that's going to waste. There are people who are setting up community spaces for children to enjoy and play. And there are people who go into parliament to petition for policy change. Those are all equal weightings of heroes. No one is above the other. Heroes are all the same. We just play our part whenever we can.
Well said. And I love that. And yeah, I think I loved what you said around the community of heroes, and also just look out there because they're already doing amazing work as you just described. So Samia, I think you're the true definition also of what a hero means. So thank you so much for the incredible work that you're doing. Thank you for taking the time to share your story, for sharing some great advice for those who want to take action.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Climate Humans. Climate Humans is produced by Josie Coulter and edited, mixed, and mastered by Ben Beheshti. Climate Humans is created and hosted by Mauricio Porras. Climate Humans is brought to you by Hero, the first platform where you can directly fund people-powered climate solutions, like the incredible people you hear on this show. You can start supporting our everyday heroes for as little as €6 per month. Just head to herocircle.app to subscribe. That's herocircle.app. In the meantime, do remember,
in order to fight for justice, you need to be nourished and not burnt out.
See you next time.